Hello!
Hello!
And welcome to episode 18 of Season to Taste! Which excitingly means we are halfway through Season to Taste.
Only halfway.
But still, that means we have another 18 episodes to go after this, so don't despair, listener. In episode 17, the randomizer sent us to season 15. And we chose the story, The Sun Makers. See, I was just testing you there because you were clearly going to...
Maybe we should go straight and test at the same time.
You were, yeah. The Invasion of Time is what we chose. And Matt, what did you think of Doctor Who and the Vardans? Or is it the Suntarans?
Well, that would be a spoiler, wouldn't it?
I think we can accept that anyone listening to this is going to get spoiled.
Oh, okay. So you mean we're not going to do it like a DVD commentary from the Doctor Who range where you've got an old companion going, "Ooh, can we say that, or is it a spoiler?" and all the rest of it.
The Suntarans arrive, the Vardans aren't the real villains, the Doctor builds the DMAC gun and he destroys them all the end.
Okay. What did I think of The Invasion of Time? I thought, like so many Graham Williams stories, I think the actual concept is fantastic and there's a really good idea in there, but the execution goes from barely competent to absolutely incompetent.
I think that's a bit harsh, personally.
Really?
Yeah, I think...
Well, you were the one that was sitting there when the Kellner pressed the button on the statue that's hidden behind a clumsy bit of bad plastering and said, "Yeah, but how will they press the button again if they need to?" Yeah. I mean, it's just silly.
No, I thought your thing of barely competent to incompetent is harsh. I'm not suggesting for a minute that episode 6 is competent. It's an absolute pile of shite. I think that the preceding 5 episodes are reasonably good and rather let down by the most ridiculous attempt at a climactic episode that the series has ever done.
Jumping towards the end, I do think that climax is weak, and I think it displays all of the weaknesses of the Key to Time climax as well, in that...
Someone's got to the end and gone, "Oh, shit,
yeah, exactly.
It's the finale.
Oh, what are we going to do? Well, we'll just build something." I think the Doctor even says, "With this gun, I could rule the universe."
Skip forward a season.
Basically what he does with the Key to Time.
Yes,
he does his wobbly eye bit and scares Romana. So
I definitely... he's quite sensitive about that. eyelid disorder.
Well, I did watch it thinking, so this is about the fourth Doctor going power mad and utterly alienating everyone around him for several episodes. So, Graham, are you writing from experience at all?
I do think that's one part of it that works, but if we look at some of the positives, it is one of the things that works really well. It's a really intriguing opening.
I agree with that.
Mincing around with some mysterious aliens, behaving out of character, but because the fourth Doctor is a bit like that, it's a kind of amplification of his darker moments. It isn't completely out of character, and so you are kind of drawn in. You're fairly sure he can't possibly be really selling out, but you want to know what's going on.
Yeah.
You're with, Leela's curiosity is exactly the same. And that actually builds for quite a while, and when the reveal comes, it's a nice reveal and a nice moment when you realise that actually this is all, the leader was right and he's been planning for it all along.
Yeah, it's almost Seventh Doctor and Ace, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, with him kind of keeping her out of it and her getting increasingly frustrated.
Except they only take 4 episodes rather than 28.
And what I also like about it is that episode 4 cliffhanger. And I kind of think, they're in a season where all the other stories are 4 episodes. Unless you're sitting down looking at the Radio Times and it's saying 4 of 6 instead of 4 of 4, you can quite feasibly sit down and it plays on the tropes of Doctor Who. And, it gets to the end of the story and he's beating the Vardans and he's having a little celebratory thing and getting ready to go off in the TARDIS. And then suddenly the Suntarans appear. And if you aren't expecting that, if you genuinely, if what you're thinking is, "Well, that was a quite disappointing ending to a 4-part story," then actually you're quite genuinely surprised when a whole bunch of monsters, and monsters you recognise, appear in the Panopticon, or in whatever set that looks like the Panopticon the TARDIS is parked in.
I'd slightly take you to task with the fact that the Suntarans are obviously recognisable. A lot of people will probably remember them, but they last appeared in 70, early 75, and this was, what, 77. So it'd been a good 2 years since they'd last been in it. So I think it's plausible.
I'm trying to think of an example in the news. I mean, the how long is it between, as one series between Blink and Silence in the Library, but then a couple... Actually, is it only one series until the Time of Angels? Well, there's in fact 2 years between Silence in the Library and the Time of Angels, isn't there?
Mm.
No one goes, well, they're not going to know who the Angels are.
Kind of, but they're not really the Angels, are they? It would be like if we got to the 50th anniversary and there was a huge reveal that the monster was Prisoner Zero. I mean, it's that kind
of... It's a monster that's been in two different stories, in two different seasons, with two different Doctors, and only a couple of years have passed without it. I think plenty of the audience... And, obviously, the impact of that finale doesn't depend on you knowing that the Santarans. Despite the fact I just said, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
The impact is there's some clearly much better monsters.
Something else has invaded.
If you know it's the Santarans and they're the big militaristic race, then you get the extra from it.
I do think the ending, to have the real oomph that it needed, there's only two monsters that you could realistically have dropped in that everyone's jaws would have hit the deck with. And that's the Daleks, and failing that, the Cybermen, who are always kind of the Dalek light substitute. So I think if you'd used either of those, it would have been a genuine, oh my goodness, everyone recognises them, wow, kind of moment. They're so hardwired into the series mythology. I think the Santarans, I'm trying to think, did they repeat anything with Santarans in? Did they appear in Who's Dot? I'm just wondering... You in the past, every time they bring back an old monster, it's apart from the Ice Warriors, which Brian Hales brought back because he was writing something with the Ice Warriors, it's always been something that's only been away for a season. Last time the Santarans came back, they were coming back from the previous season.
You say apart from the Ice Warriors, the Ice Warriors are exactly on the level with the Santarans. They are that second tier monster. So don't rule out the one that's most like the Santarans and say, well, that's different because they're the same writer. It's not different. It's the same thing. It's several years apart, and they're bringing back an old monster that's only been in two previous stories. It's exactly the same.
I think you're missing my point, which is that essentially Brian Hales brought back the Ice Warriors. It wasn't a production team decision, really.
Well, it makes no difference to the audience whatsoever.
The Santarans are brought back as though they're some kind of big monster, and it's a big deal.
Well, it is a big deal, because they're a big monster that's invaded Gallifrey, and I think just because you don't particularly care for them, you underestimate the impact of them. And it's obviously, if it had been the Daleks, that would be more impact. But frankly, most stories where a monster turns up, it would have had more impact if it was the Daleks, because the Daleks are the Daleks.
Yeah.
And yes, if the Daleks had invaded Gallifrey at that point, that would have been quite a dramatic moment.
I think it would be a hard story to tell with the Daleks. So I think
they'd have had trouble getting around the TARDIS corridors.
Yeah, and I think a better monster would have been the Cybermen. I think it's the kind of thing that the Cybermen are perfectly designed for, because they're recognisable enough and famous enough that the general audience would have had that kind of wow factor, and yet they're kind of big and weighty enough that you could kind of see, well, they could invade Gallifrey.
Yeah.
The Santarans feel a little bit third tier. But okay, fair enough, it's the Santarans, and I do quite like them, I just don't think they're as big a deal as that cliffhanger makes out.
I think the cliffhanger is very much focused on some much better monsters than the Vardans, and I think we can agree,
yeah.
The Vardans are utterly awful, and so the idea that someone else who's better than the Vardans has turned up is a reasonable surprise.
Yeah, that's true, but then, undermining them even further, the Santarans are really rubbish in the last two episodes. They've got this lisping, awful leader who's not a patch on Kevin Lindsay, who's played every Santaran we've previously seen. And Derek Deadman just isn't as good. His makeup, we were having a bit of a debate. I think it's not particularly good. I think it looks really a bit plasticky and crap.
I think his handle is quite plasticky and rubbish. I think the actual head is fine. The sense in which it isn't fine is it's nowhere near as good as the one that Kevin Lindsay has, or the two that Kevin Lindsay has. But then, of course, we've established that people don't remember the Santarans, so they won't mind that it doesn't look as good as the previous ones. It looks like Nosferatu in the wrong aspect ratio, doesn't it? He's got these little teeth and the bald head. I mean, I think
And big, baggy eyes.
Yeah, having seen the ones in the Two Doctors, you are forgiven nearly every other Santarin costume.
Yeah.
The worst bit is when he's got the helmet on and there's close-ups of the eyes and it doesn't look like they've actually bothered sticking down the head mask behind the helmet. And so you actually just see human eyes and then a bit of latex flapping around. And then that's the worst.
Yeah, it does look particularly poor.
The voice is terrible, though.
And the voice is terrible.
You've got this lisping Londoner Santarin, presumably to counteract the Glaswegian or whatever he is, Vardan.
Yeah. So I think the Santarins aren't particularly great. I think it's probably, despite the fact that it's their biggest ever plan to invade Gallifrey, it's probably their weakest appearance. Definitely their weakest appearance to date, and probably ties with the Two Doctors is a particularly weak entry.
The Two Doctors are just terrible.
Although, interestingly, it is the first time that the Doctor mentions Santarins in the same breath as Daleks and Cybermen, which the next Baker's going to do in his most famous scene.
You know, the Doctor clearly has the view that the Santarins are the next best monster after the Daleks and the Cybermen,
but the Doctor's probably got a weird, he probably thinks, I don't know, the Mechanoids are a really important monster because he had quite fun fighting them or something like that. We should ignore whatever he says. He's a biased witness.
But yeah, the Vardans, I think we can agree, are not up there with the best monsters ever. Every now and again, I like the way that, I mean, this is a story that subverts the show in a way that only the script editor and the producer writing it could get away with.
Mm.
So it has a lot of running around corridors, almost, particularly in that last episode.
Do you think that's subversion? Or do you think it's desperation?
No, I think it's rubbish, but I think it's intended humorously. And the fact that it ties into a bit of a stereotype of running around corridors, I think, amuses them. And, you know, and then it's explained as the Doctor's maybe trying to leave a trail that's going to confuse the Santarins. But no, but I was thinking more of the Vardans are these shimmery things. And, you know, maybe a lot of this is tied into the budget, but they're kind of rather rubbish, shimmery aluminium foil things. And you look at them and go, oh my God, are these the monsters that are invading Gallifrey? This is dreadful. And then the Doctor says, oh, they're just, you know, these annoying shimmery things we have to look at because they haven't materialised yet.
Yeah.
And you think, well, fair enough, even within the story, those aren't the actual monsters, they're the monsters' kind of dodgy representations of themselves. And then when they appear, and you watch and go, are they just humanoid idiots?
Mm.
Then one of the characters says, oh, they're just humanoids, and the Doctor says, disappointing, aren't they? And you kind of think,
yes, they are.
Yes, they are disappointing. Drawing attention to that may not be a good thing, but it's the kind of thing that,
it's the kind of thing that fans have been debating since Graham Williams was the producer, isn't it? Because on the one hand, it's a meta acknowledgement of the limitations of the series, and you're going to get Douglas Adams getting plaudits for writing No-Look Rocks in season 17. It's exactly in that vein. So on the one hand, you could say, well, it's just a kind of meta recognition that Doctor Who isn't really that good. Or, you know,
well, it's not that it isn't really that good, it's that the budget isn't necessarily going to stretch to, you know, an exciting rubber suit when it doesn't need to.
Yeah, okay. I was using shorthand, but yes, I agree. Alternatively, you could look at it and say, well, it's a bit of an excuse for not really making much more effort to make them an interesting monster.
Mm.
And actually, if you bothered to put the effort and time into designing the costumes properly, then you probably wouldn't have needed to do that line. And I'm not sure there's, you know, I flip between the two points of view.
Well, the costumes are in about half an episode, aren't they?
Because why would you spend the money and time on them for half an episode?
And actually,
it's quite a funny line.
It is, and you know, that like a lot of other races, they are humanoid. It explains why one of them is Scottish. You assume they're just slightly annoyed humans who are from Stan. I assume from the planet Vardo, although why it then takes him so long to work out that's trace the signal back. But then, of course, the point is they're not the real monster. The Santarins are the real monster. Yeah. And so it's also about, actually, the reason they don't spend a lot of effort on them as the monster is because they're not the real monster in the show.
I kind of agree. I think the last point on the Vardans is the actual idea, a monster that can travel on any wavelength.
Mm.
It can read people's thoughts, it can travel down electronic wavelengths, etc., radio wavelengths, is really quite interesting. However, then they turn out to be some humans in silly hats and green kind of combats.
Yeah.
It's almost a metaphor for the invasion of time. Great ideas, but disappointing execution.
My last thought on the Vardens is that bit in the first episode where first and second episodes where they're developing their plans happening and they're following it on Gallifrey and it keeps cutting back to them, which helps tell us that they're kind of behind it and there's a plot going on and helps rank up the tension. But some of the cuts are just ridiculously fast. You know, it cuts back to the Vardan spaceship and one of them's going, "Yay, come on!" And then it cuts back to Gallifrey again, and it jerks you in and out of the story. They're not quite long enough interjected scenes.
Mm.
Yeah, you kind of have half a sentence in the Panopticon, two words on the Vardan ship, and then another half a sentence in the Panopticon, and you're jerked around the story.
So, you mentioned Gallifrey there. What do you think about the execution of Gallifrey in this story?
I think it's interesting. Obviously, a lot of it is... I mean, the sets are being reused from The Deadly Assassin.
Yeah.
Which is possibly a cost-saving measure. Well, it is, but I mean, they may have got, if we set it somewhere we've already got sets, then...
They look strangely less greasy and dark than they did in The Deadly Assassin.
They do. It's like they've had a clean-up after what happened there. They've had to put the Panopticon floor back.
And invested in some new lighting. In fact, they've invested in quite a lot from Habitat, presumably.
And a lot of moulded plastic chairs that are quite ugly.
And some kind of bizarre water features in the Panopticon as well. It looks like little lily pads.
Yeah.
I think it's more
Argos than...
Probably Argos. But you can understand why the designers doing Ark of Infinity a few years later, if they'd watched that story, Ark of Infinity gets a kicking for the ridiculous chairs and water features and pot plants all over Gallifrey. But actually, the Invasion of Time, it's just following on from the Invasion of Time. It's very authentic to the last time the planet appeared on screen. And I think actually the Invasion of Time is more like Ark of Infinity's Gallifrey than it is the Deadly Assassin's Gallifrey.
It's a lot less grubby, although the planet, the design itself, I was going to say it has a coherent feel, but in the same way that the inside of the TARDIS doesn't when half of it's on film...
Mm.
Gallifrey doesn't either. When, like, kind of the downstairs bit with the transduction barriers is on film, it just feels like a different location. Mm. They do quite a good job of reusing sets elsewhere. The Castellan's office is clearly the same set as Rodan's room, just shot from a slightly different angle and redressed. I think the president's office, before it's redecorated, is used in another scene where Leela's going through all the clothes.
Mm.
I think it's basically the same wall behind her. Yeah, the TARDIS is parked in a hall, which isn't the Panopticon, I think.
Mm.
Or it's moved to a hall, which isn't the Panopticon, but is the Panopticon set, which actually confused me for a while. It has this hexagonal pattern on the floor, which, of course, is quite like the hexagonal console.
Yeah.
In the TARDIS.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And then there's, of course, the outside of Gallifrey, which I think is realised quite well, kind of orangey.
It is, and when you get the shot of the Vardan spaceship over Gallifrey, it's this kind of big swirling orange, which I was watching it and I thought, oh, wow, the End of Time really references this.
Cause
they just use this look again for when it comes back in that episode.
Well, then the difference in the way it's shown on screen in... stories like The Sound of Drums, where you have that orangey landscape and the citadel, is, of course, you see the citadel.
Yeah.
There's actually no connect on screen. And I think they quite cunningly achieved, you know, you don't really notice until you stop and think about it. But you don't see anyone go from the citadel to outside or vice versa.
No.
The moment you see people outside, they're just beyond a ridge. And you're going, the city's just over there on the top of the ridge. But unfortunately, we won't be able to see it. And they come down that way and they go back that way. But you never actually see the city from outside or see outside from the city.
I think they managed that fairly well, though. I think what surprises me more is that there's this weird group of people living outside the citadel who are ex-Time Lords. And it turns out that they're some kind of 70s hippie dropouts. So it's like the Gallifreyan good life. It's just utterly... It's an utterly bizarre twist on the whole planet. I just find it quite interesting. We also get our first female Time Lord, don't we, in Rodan?
Oh,
we've never seen one before.
In Barbara, who goes to live outside with Tom.
Yeah.
Yes, I quite like Rodan, or Perry, as I can't help thinking of her all the way through. Or indeed, Romana, as I can't help thinking of her all the way through. It is like Romana, played by Nicola Bryant. It's Romana Zero. Right. I mean, she's in the story before Romana's introduced, and you can't help thinking, although Romana's a bit more Glam Tam. It's still very, very similar character-wise, and you kind of think it should have... If they'd thought ahead and knew that's what they were going to do, I think you'd retrospectively have made it Romana, introduce her a story earlier, as they kind of do with Nyssa, yeah. Or, you know, someone like Catherine Tate gets to appear earlier, or indeed Lala kind of appears in the story before, and then there's a contrivance to explain that. I think it could easily have been Romana, and you'd have a... they'd at least have known each other at the beginning of the next story.
Yeah, they didn't really do handover episodes in the 70s, did they? I suppose the Armageddon Factor's won by accident rather than design. I think the first time they really did handovers was season 18, when they were going back for this kind of 60s ongoing serial nature. In the 70s, up until that point, it was really goodbye, and then the next season or episode, hello to the next one. Yeah, I wonder whether Rodan was a dry run for Romana and Graham Williams had already had the conception that there might be a Time Lady companion, and she maybe just wasn't quite, the actress maybe wasn't quite what he was looking for, or whether he saw the character and thought, oh, actually, yeah, that might be quite a good contrast to Leela.
I don't know what the timescales of how things happened were. I mean, I suspect more the latter. I suspect because I think, didn't they basically not quite get around to asking Louise Jameson to stay? You know, there was, they rather mucked up. That's why it's such a perfunctory departure. Yeah. They just kind of assumed she'd carry on. And then when she wasn't going to, I think it's maybe a similar thing with Mary Tam as well.
Yeah, I think that's one of the flaws of that production team, is that they seem to max out on their grand designs for, you know, vast season story arcs, but they drop the small stuff like, oh, have we got the actors on contract for next year? Have we written them a departure scene? Have we actually got our scripts in order? That's kind of where it fell down a little bit. And I think you're right, Louise Jameson, I believe the story, something like Graham Williams believed he could persuade her to stay right up until practically the last day in studio, and then realise, oh, she's not going to stay. Oh, well, we better write her out then. Oh, she can marry Andred.
That's why I think he probably wasn't planning ahead for a Time Lord companion, because he just kind of thought, well, it'll be her.
But I think as a result of that, Leela, one of the most interesting companions and one of the best actresses to be a companion, gets a pretty piss-poor departure.
She has the nice moment where she and K-9 are kind of lowering their heads. But apart from that, it's a rather... I mean, of all the characters to kind of be written out by falling in love and staying behind with someone, it seemed odd for it to be Leela.
I mean, a far better departure would be Lesbian, the leader of the Outsiders, has been killed, so
she takes Leela over,
takes
leading,
over leading the Outsiders. That would be a kind of noble and worthy end for her, not married off to some Gallifreyan guard.
Or even something quite ridiculous where, you know, you'd have to contrive it more through the story, but where they basically say, well, if the Doctor's going and he's not going to be president, we recognise that our society is failing and we need someone to lead us who is going to be rather more proactive and, you know, make Leela...
They get Lesbian to be the president and he takes Leela as his wife.
Lesbian, by the way, is Matt's mishearing of Nesbin, the leader of the Outsiders, just in case you thought he was talking about Rodan. Yeah, it's unlikely in the context of this story, but it had been written a bit differently, you could get to a point where at the end they just went, we're not managing to lead ourselves, we've created a just defunct society, and we actually need someone a bit spunky to jazz us up.
Okay. I think that's an interesting idea. Ultimately, though, it's not a departure on the level of, you know, Joe or Sarah Jane.
Oh, goodness.
Where there's actually much pathos in it. I agree, where Leela and K-9 lower their heads, it's a bit of a sad moment. And the Doctor looks vaguely regretful for about half a second when he closes the door on her.
So he starts faffing around.
But then he just giggles. It just feels like a bit of a cursory goodbye to a companion who's been there for 18 months and is really quite memorable.
Yeah, and who, and one of the things I like about this story is actually, because the Doctor's off doing his whole pretending to be evil bit, Leela is separated from him and gets to be the protagonist in her half of the story. And she's darting around, she's rousing the Outsiders, she's getting on with Rodan. She's very much leading her half of the story, and Louise Jameson gets to do loads of good stuff and has funny moments. She has some probably funny moments with Rodan, and she's kind of teasing her back. And just genuinely being incredibly watchable all the way through, and you do think, yeah, she kind of deserves a better send-off than a last-minute, unforeshadowed, oh, yeah, I'm staying now.
Yeah. Yeah, so Leela's departure is one of the things that I was thinking about when I said incompetence. So I think that is an incompetent way to write out a regular character, and I think it reflects very poorly on Graham Williams as a producer that he allowed that to happen. And that's why, for all that he gets praised, I just don't think he was very good.
Just going back to how Gallifrey's portrayed, because it's about the design, but the actual society itself, I think is... there are some interesting approaches. I mean, it's, the story kind of has an element of that of the political thriller to it. I mean, not in a particularly subtle way, but the Castellan is very much the obsequious, I for one welcome our new Vardan stroke Sontaran overlords character, you know, sliming his way
should
through.
Should have a sign that says "Hail Vardans" in the background. Yeah, crossed out Sontarans. Yeah,
and then you know you have lots of nice stuff with what Bruiser does and doesn't know, how the Doctor's trying to deceive him and he's trying to cover things from the Doctor, and all along they're both actually good and then work together. I quite like their interplay. I also quite like the idea that the guards are all a bit rubbish, but then they would be a bit rubbish because they never get to do anything. And it's very much a kind of, it feels like a kind of really cheap national service that they're doing. And even like Andred with his stupid cape, it feels very much like his uniform is about posturing and about status, and isn't really about what's a useful attire for someone on a planet that never really has to deal with any violent uprising.
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't get that from this episode. I think, taken in context with the Deadly Assassin, you could kind of read that into it, but in the context of just what you see here, there's obviously the outsiders are all armed and they don't attack the capital, but there's clearly some kind of unrest and discontent in the society on the planet. You don't get the same sense that it's this decrepit society of old men that you do in The Deadly Assassin. There's a lot more young people, the guards are much younger, there's a bit of dynamism because there's people who reject that society.
But I think even then that's it. The guards are younger, as if it's kind of something that the young people are forced to do.
Yeah.
While all the people, you know, hanging around at the inauguration, apart from Kellner, and obviously we don't know how old they are because how old they are isn't necessarily how old they are because they're Time Lords. But there's still a feeling like the Surgeon General's very old, Gold Usher's reasonably old. It is the Vatican, isn't it? The Cardinals and the investiture of the man dressed in white.
And then you've got the kind of Swiss Guard, Chancellery Guard type analogy. Yeah, okay, I get that.
The other kind of political thriller thing, it's not particularly clever, but it's a nice touch, is all the stuff about Kellner kind of rounding up people who disagree, and there's a very kind of 1984 stroke fascist thing about this is him taking the opportunity to anyone who's crossed his path who he thinks isn't going to help his route through. Yeah, it's kind of House of Cards done on the cheap in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But it's a nice touch and gives more depth to Time Lord society.
Mm.
The other thing I like about the story, there is, and again, it does feel like the people writing it kind of letting themselves go a bit and having a bit of fun, but there is quite a bit of just witty, bantery dialogue. The Doctor has a lot of quite smart lines back at people. There's a bit where someone, I think it might be Andred, one of the guards says, if I do that, the Castellan will have me shot. And the Doctor says, that's okay, I'll have him shot. And it's that kind of bouncy.
Yeah.
Or even at the end, when you know the Doctor doesn't mean it, it tells Leela not to kill Kellner. And then when he doesn't answer his question, says to kill Kellner. And you know he doesn't mean it, but it's him kind of calling his bluff.
Yeah.
And there are just lots of back and forth with him and Bruiser that's a lot of fun when they're running around and...
Oh, Bruiser's great.
Bruiser's... They're running down the corridor and old Bruiser is not out of breath and the Doctor's quite out of breath. I like that. And their interplay is very enjoyable. There's just a lot of very relaxed, fun bantery dialogue.
Yes.
That I do enjoy a lot. Unfortunately, I can't hear as much as well as I might do some of that, because K-9 is bloody loud.
Oh, God,
in this
awful,
story. His motor's just churning, and I hope K-9 Mark II in the box at the end has been properly oiled or is just a better device, because he was drowning out scenes with his stupid... Even the Leela's departure scene at the end, you can't even see K-9 while that scene's going on, but you can just hear him whirring away over this departure conversation.
Yeah.
Another thing I don't like, and it's a very minor thing, is the Doctor's stupid white necktie thing that he's wearing. I don't know what possessed him to... I mean, I can quite understand, you know, what possessed him to try and take over Gallifrey and allow the Vardens on St. Thomas to invade.
Or a giant scarf.
And wear a giant scarf.
But that's ridiculously huge in this.
It is particularly big. And I was starting to watch out for continuity gaffes with how he'd put the scarf on. The moments that I checked for it, it was actually done quite well, given he was kind of jumping from film to video and place to place. Actually, the consistency of how he'd done the scarf...
Yeah.
Was quite good, but yeah, that horrible white
necktie. It was
about
2 feet wide, this scarf.
It was folded over at some points and stretched out at others. I mean, it must be very warm.
Do you think that was a different scarf than he used to wear in the previous series?
I have no idea.
It looks much bigger.
It looks incredibly bulky, though. Yeah. Although it does give him the opportunity to hide the sash behind it and then occasionally, like a flasher, open his coat and show the sash dangling down in quite a dirty way. Other little slightly odd things, and there's one of the guards is particularly bad in the first episode, just like every line comes out rubbish.
Yeah.
I was really confused by the doors into some of the offices, which appeared to open outwards if you were in the corridor, but inwards if you were in the room.
They're dimensionally transcendental.
But yeah, they do seem to be dimensionally transcendental, those rooms. Not only did the president's offices doors open outwards, but they looked different on the back of the door. Maybe there was a tiny little antechamber, but they didn't seem to be the way the thuds were.
That would have been quite a cheap way to do it. They could have just put a door in the middle of their quarry where they filmed the outside and said, well, that's the Capitol. And Lee said, but it's huge. And it's like, yeah, it's dimensionally transcendental. The whole Capitol's just behind a wooden door.
Yes. My only other specific thing I wanted to say was, even though you do go... why is a key necessary to power... You know, assume that isn't a real key. There is more to it than that, to power the DMAC gun, or arm the DMAC gun. And I like all the stuff about, you know, the Doctor finding it in Bruiser's office and getting Bruiser to hand it over and the battle of wits between them. I don't quite understand how, if every Chancellor has looked after the key and the President's never had it, presumably no Chancellor has ever become President. Or when they've put the coronet on, that it's quietly wiped their brain as to where the great key is.
Yeah, maybe it does. Maybe that's the point. I have to say that gun, the fact that the whole six parts builds up to the Doctor creating a gun to go and shoot some Sontarans, it just doesn't particularly seem in keeping with...
It's not very Doctor Who, is it? I think, at least it makes it a big thing. It makes it something that's not supposed to exist. And, you know, it's a huge blast... albeit because of the grenade more than anything, that knocks the Doctor out and makes him forget all about it at the end. But it's still, whereas the rest of the story is deliberately out of character for the plot, and he's pretending to be out of character, it is quite an odd thing for him to do. I mean, admittedly, if it had been the Daleks, it's probably the only way he could have defeated them. But it doesn't seem quite so necessary for the Sontarans, where you can just, there's only about five of them, throw some daggers in the back of their... I think in the book, the gun is supposed to... dematerialised the entire Sontaran fleet.
I think it was meant to, yeah, because otherwise Sontaran fleet's still in orbit, isn't it?
But it doesn't matter because they've closed the force field, so it doesn't matter anymore because Gallifrey's protected again. All that matters is not letting the DMAC gun fall into their hands. So of course he does that by building it.
The thing, and it's another one of those weapons where the Doctor makes huge claims about it, and Barusa is aghast that he's created it.
And then it's just a little gun.
It's a gun, you kind of wonder, well, so it dematerialises people.
Is that a lot different from shooting?
Haven't we seen kind of matter destructor guns before?
Yeah.
Is it really that?
You can kind of believe, if it's
horrific,
like a cannon that destroys an entire fleet in one blast, you can then see. Because then when the Doctor's claim about being able to rule the universe with you, you do go, well, unless someone comes up behind you and just hits you.
It's almost like it needed to reverse time or something like that, and whatever
gets
shot, it reverses. that whole timeline, or I don't know, so, you know, something like that.
It's just nowhere near as amazing as it's built up to be in the script.
You kind of find it hard to take over the universe with one gun, really, wouldn't you?
So, yeah, I found the story... I mean, it's a cheap... It feels cheap, but it has some really good stuff with Leela. It has a chance for Tom to play a different kind of Doctor. The switch from the Vardans to the Centaurans is nicely surprising. Bruce is fun. Kellner's fun. Andred's actually pretty good. But it is cheap. I think the comedy just about works without falling into parody, although it treads a dangerous line at times. But then it just all falls apart in that last episode. And it's just the tedious wandering around the TARDIS followed by a MacGuffin gun.
I think I said this in the last one, but season 15 is the first ever series of Doctor Who where the season's worse than the preceding seasons in terms of the competence with which it's made, the look of it, and the overall quality of the series. And I think The Invasion of Time does feel like an, oh my god, the money's run out spectacular. If you put that against The Talons of Weng Chiang, The Seeds of Doom, Genesis of the Daleks, you know, even Planet of the Spiders, the last few six-parters, it just doesn't hold up to the same extent that they do. Although I think, I agree with you, there's loads of lovely moments, and I do believe a fantastic, a really great central idea. I just wish Graham Williams had had more opportunities to write for the series rather than produce it, because I think his real skill was creating these stories, and if he'd been supported and helped, you know, maybe even a script editor, if he'd been supported in that kind of role, I think he would have been magnificent. I think his deficiencies as a producer then start to really damage those 3 years that he was in charge of.
Well, that's The Invasion of Time. So let's see which season we should taste next. I'll switch on the randomizer, and it's the randomizer version 2. To mark our halfway point, I have reconstructed the randomizer. I've made a few little tweaks here. Basically, I've added a VLOOKUP to the randomizer's circuits.
Is that so that it doesn't?
It's basically so that it doesn't keep picking the ones you've already done. Dear listener, there have been quite a few instances where I've edited out and you've actually heard about the fifth attempt to get the randomizer to pick a season.
How do you VLOOKUP to do that, then?
I'll show you later. It's definitely not an Excel spreadsheet. It is actually quite a good thing. Anyway,
okay.
I'll show Matthew the circuitry of the randomizer later. But for now, let's see which season we will taste next. Well, I think this will make you quite happy, Matt. There are only 4 stories in this season.
Okay.
And I think that means actually you can tell immediately what it is. Because we've done all the Sylvester McCoy ones.
Oh, so it's John Pertwee's first series.
It is. It is season 7.
Okay.
So we have 1 4-parter and 4 7-parters.
Yep.
Spearhead, Silurians, Ambassadors and Doctor Who and the Inferno of Death.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of choice. I have an idea in my head which one I want to do, but you kick off.
Well, we have just got Spearhead from Space on Blu-ray. However, I'm not proposing that we watch Spearhead from Space again. I think it's so overly familiar. I've probably watched it almost more than any other story. I've certainly got more copies of it than any other story.
We should give one away in an exciting podcast competition.
The problem is, all the extras are different on the DVD and the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I would certainly get rid of the DVD. The Silurians, I think, is fantastic. I'd be happy with Doctor Who and the Silurians, call it by its name. Inferno's great. I think it's one of... It's come in for a bit of a slagging off in some quarters over the last few years. It's been a bit of a tendency to reappraise it downwards, but I still think it's absolutely stunning and I love it. The one that I'm most interested in watching is The Ambassadors of Death, because I've never seen it in colour.
Oh, right.
And now it exists in colour in full on DVD.
It's amazing what they do with those crayons.
It is, yeah. I'm quite up for watching a bit of colour Ambassadors.
Oh, well, see, what I was going to say was, There are three stories in this season, because it's such a good season, that I have seen loads and loads and loads of times. I saw Spearhead years, I think one of the earliest, it is the earliest Pertwee, but in time for me, one of the earliest times I saw Pertwee, I think, was Spearhead was one of the early ones. Inferno, I've seen loads. I think the last time I watched Inferno was maybe the day that Nick Courtney died, actually. I think it was kind of, I watched it as a late night memorial. Silurians, was one of those ones I had on VHS with the little paintbrush.
Oh, the recolour art, yeah.
Just
the Demons had one as well, didn't it?
And Terror of the Autumns. I think maybe one of them didn't have the paintbrush, even though it was also restored, but two of them
I think it was Terror of the Autumns. Inconsistent. The Demons did.
I used to very much enjoy watching that. But actually, the Ambassadors of Death is the one that I've seen by far the least, and there's certainly lots of fun to be had there. And it's the one I think that gets ignored the most as well. I know it's partly to do with the rate, way in which the videos were released, and it was the last one of the four to come out as well.
Well, it's the last one of the four because they could never get a stable colour signal.
It means that it didn't kind of get the exposure. And I think the others as well have, for various reasons, you know, the Silurians are a popular race.
Mm.
The Inferno, obviously, is quite a unique story, and Spearhead, by virtue of both being John Pertwee's first and introducing the Nesting and the Autons and being all on film,
and being the first colour story.
Yeah, all of that gives it a lot of focus, and you have the Ambassadors of Death kind of sat in that season as the poor relation.
I mean, it's only been released very recently on DVD, again, because I think the actual colour is a combination of the off-air tapes from the US transmission, off-air recording, and this new chroma dot process. So I think they've done a kind of strange hybrid of the two, because
I was about to jokingly mention chroma dots, and then you undermined my attempt at joke by them actually being part of the thing.
No, it is. They use the chroma dots because there's this strange rainbow. If you remember, when the VHS came out, it faded between colour and black and white through quite a few of the episodes, because there's this funny, strange rainbow interference pattern on the off-air colour recordings, which meant that when they tried to use them to colourise it, it just looked awful.
It was a bit weird, actually, because there was a similar thing. It's a similar thing with the Invasion of Time, isn't it? And that when they looked, if you look like really closely at the master video tape, and you really kind of zoom in and zoom in, there is actually a good story in there. It's just concealed. Well, that was pretty simple. It's seven episodes, so we may be a while, but we will watch Doctor Who and the Doctor Who and the Ambassadors of Death.
I can't wait.
Excellent. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.